Hi, everyone. A slow but national growing trend is for states to emphasize pre-K access for young students, although statistics show that as of 2023, only about 21% of 3- and 4-year-olds have access to state-funded preschool. Such programs are expanding because of the significant short-term and long-term benefits for students and communities. The Journal of the National Association of State Boards of Education noted last year that, quote, new universal preschool initiatives in states around the country are poised to generate an unprecedented boom in state-funded preschool over the next decade, end quote. As such programs unfold, learning success stories on how to cultivate high-impact learning practices will be essential. We'll be tackling that concept on this episode of Teaching Matters.
Welcome to Teaching Matters, a podcast exploring all things teaching and learning. Teaching Matters is produced by NPR affiliate WOUV Public Media in Athens, Ohio. And here is your host, Dr. Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University.
Thank you, Trinity. Carmelo Piazza is the Executive Director and Education Director for the Brooklyn Preschool of Science. He is known as Carmelo the Science Fellow. Carmelo taught science at PS 261 in New York for 16 years, where he developed a passion for using science as a method for teaching students multiple key subjects. In 2013, he opened the Brooklyn Preschool of Science, which now has two different locations in the city. Carmelo was a guest on Teaching Matters in the October 5th, 2021 episode titled Science and Imagination. Carmelo, it's great to have you back, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back again. I'm a little grayer than the last time.
Both of us are, but still smiles on our face, right? We're still having fun. So
when you love what you do, really, it's not work.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, you were on, you know, quite a while ago. For listeners that haven't listened to that episode, I kind of want to start just by having you talk about your background. You know, what have you taught? How did you get into teaching? What is it that drives your passion as an educator?
Yeah, I guess I could say the whole science genre was more like an accidental discovery. You know, my undergrad was in elementary ed. I got offered a fourth grade position, went on an interview, and at the end of it all, they decided I was too new, too green is the term. They didn't give me that position. But lo and behold, the science teacher who took the fourth grade position, right, said, hey, why don't you take the science position? And it kind of just shows you perspective of how the science meant nothing, because if I wasn't good enough to teach fourth grade, why would a new 22-year-old teacher be good enough to teach science? But lo and behold, I took the position. And I did have a science methodology class at Brooklyn College that I fell in love with, the whole inquiry-based model, and started teaching. And I swear to you, within my first week, I had parents come to me and just say, like, who are you and what is it that you're doing? Because my kid's been in this school for the last 4 years, never once spoke of science, had you for 1 week, and is loving it already. Mm-hmm. And that kind of became contagious. And I just realized how important it is when you are teaching children in a hands-on method, using inquiry as the power of motivation, cross-cutting concepts. Learning becomes self-explanatory. They don't even realize that they're learning because it's that much fun. And that then kind of manifested to me opening up a center for kids, which was called Carmelo the Science Fellow at the Cosmic Cove, which then in turn became my schools. And, you know, I've written kids' books. It's just sometimes you got to follow your heart and your passion. I almost left education and got my master's in speech language pathology. It was a very expensive lesson because I was a semester away pretty much from getting my master's in speech pathology. But I got so sad and depressed that I needed to leave teaching. And I dropped out of the program and then followed my heart, and here I am today, you know?
When you say inquiry-based, I mean, you know, many people will be familiar with that term on a broad sense. What does that mean to you?
Okay. When you ask a child a question, right? I know it sounds so cliche to say that kids are natural-born scientists, but there's a reason why the child that's sitting on a high chair is spilling things, because it's cause and effect. They're experimenting, right? Now, we seem to forget that even a 7-year-old, even a 15-year-old goes to a diner, and when the waitress or waiter says, don't touch the plate, it's too hot, everybody's like, huh, how hot is it? They all feel like they want to touch, right? We don't lose the ability to the act of doing. And the beauty of when you start a day as an educator with a beautiful inquiry block, it creates the act of asking a question. It creates the act of wanting to do. It creates the act of problem solving, which is something that we, unfortunately, as they get older, meaning kids, we forget the importance of asking questions, but when they're so young, it's just so innate. And this is what I believed is the beauty and the power of inquiry. It just creates beautiful foundations in learning. Mm-hmm. Kids who even have behavioral issues are so engrossed in activities that it's so minimal, you know, and it just consumed my passion to just create a curriculum where this is just our focus every day. Every day we start with an inquiry block and let's just see where it takes us.
You know, a couple of months ago, we had a guest on that talked about this concept of plasticity of the brain. We weren't talking about it, as I recall from that episode, about it being different among different age groups, although, of course, you know, it would be. But, you know, as you describe this inquiry-based philosophy that you have, it just strikes me that when children are young and they're actively experimenting, that's sort of showing that their brain is ready to soak in and ready to grow, ready to make connections.
I agree. And I could kind of prove the point, right? My former principal, who unfortunately passed away, Zipporia Mills, big mentor of mine. I loved her. The kids in New York City in the fourth grade have to take two state science exams, an objectives and a manipulatives, a hands-on portion and a factual portion. They would only see me one day a week for 45 minutes. That was it, right? And there was no formal hands-on science education happening in the classroom. It's all literacy, math, not saying that those are not important, but zero science. And every year we would get the state test scores back in. Miss Mills would call me into the office and I'm always like, what did I do? And she would say, it really is amazing. You see them one day a week for 45 minutes and the kids were averaging fours across the board, which is the highest you can get. And I'm talking in the objectives exam, there would be a question like person's talking on the phone, sound energy is being converted to what type of energy? Where the average adult would be like, wait, what? And my kids are getting those answers right. Again, if you teach in a manner in which kids don't even realize that they're learning because it's fun, because they're engaged, because they're motivated, the learning just becomes so natural. And you're right in regards to plasticity of the brain. Like, that's just the way it should be. We've kind of shifted away from that type of approach in terms of education. I just think we need to revert back. And there are a lot of schools that are opening up now, you know, with that kind of like the Alpha School in Manhattan, just all that hands-on learning, even going older, you know?
Yeah. So it's actually a really good transition. Can you kind of talk about the origin story of the Brooklyn Preschool of Science? You were one of the first science-focused, if not the first, in the city. I mean, that's pretty impressive. Can you talk about how it started?
Yeah, it kind of started when my principal brought me into the office and made me realize how effective, right? Like, there's a direct correlation between inquiry, cross-cutting concepts, fun, and proven results. And my wife is also a teacher, and we had a center called Carmelo the Science Fellow where we did a lot of play groups and after-school classes. And one day I'm driving down Wyckoff Street here in Brooklyn, and I see a space for rent. It says community use facility, possible childcare. I look at my wife looks at me, and I'm like, why don't we just take this bigger? Instead of doing after school classes and 1 hour play groups, let's just build a curriculum where STEAM and STEM is the focus, and let's just see where it goes. And you know what? It did become one school, it then became two. I did open up a third, and I've always wanted more. I'm getting older now, post-COVID, I kind of lost a little bit of my thunder there, but I do believe that this is something that should be universal in terms of how kids should be learning, especially with the advances in technology and AI. Everything is going to become a STEAM-based career. Yeah. Why not start it at the age of 2, 3, and 4?
Yeah, yeah. And I would assume, you know, as I was reading and refamiliarizing myself with the Brooklyn Preschool, you have a lot of things built into the school, like your plant wall and your aquarium. Can you kind of just, you know, if we walked in and, you know, listeners from around the country were able to, you know, take a field trip and see what a day looks like in the school, what would they see?
I would say imagine a zoo and a museum and a preschool had a baby. You get my school. Why is that so magical? Well, one, we're working with young children. Mm-hmm. Separation anxiety. You could have a child that comes in from September through November, then all of a sudden in December, they just want their mom and they want their parent and they want their every day. When you have a school that's so stimulating, aesthetically pleasing, We have 20 different animals. We have bunnies, you know, Madagascar cockroaches. There's living walls. There's just so much in terms of redirecting a child's energy at the time when it may be needed. Like, mm-hmm. if there's a child named Josiah who just really wants his dad, you know how easy it is to be like, oh, buddy, I know you want your dad, but guess what? Let's just go get the carrot and let's go feed Fluffy the bunny. Trust me, when Fluffy the bunny is on Josiah's lap and there's a carrot, at that moment, we're not thinking about daddy.
Yeah.
Right? So, and more importantly, I get really jealous of schools in suburbia where rural communities like Warwick, New York, where birds and bees and newts and salamanders are so tangible. But kids in the city are, if I take out a Madagascar cockroach, which we have, every parent's first reaction is, that's disgusting, right? But a 2 and 3 year old, they have not yet been taught that. Mm-hmm. When you get them when they're so young, you were able to lay such beautiful foundations. So again, you have to think outside the box, especially being in Brooklyn, New York, where you know you get the occasional roach and mouse, but no one wants to touch those. But it's still no excuse. Bring them in, like literally in my office, you know, fun little, we have geckos, you know? I mean, yeah. I do my best to just like really provide kids with just the most amazing foundations in what an early life experience I believe should be like, you know?
I love the way you sort of framed that. You know, obviously in a place like Brooklyn, you have many assets that we wouldn't in, you know, southern rural Ohio. And then at the same time, your point's very well taken that we have assets that you would not have. I think this idea of merging STEAM with place is so fundamentally important, but then also figuring out how you enlarge the space, you know, so we don't have Brooklyn here. So what can we do to help students understand, you know, concepts? I'm talking as an adult right now, not as a preschool teacher, but understanding concepts of urbanization and those sorts of things. I think it's fascinating to help students understand the assets of place, but then broaden their world, you know, expand it.
100% agreed. You know, I feel like if I had a school in Warwick, there would be limitations that I wouldn't be, like, for, I'll give you a perfect example. Where in December, we did a unit on measuring, right? And there's a local pizzeria that does trips for kids. But wait, not just trips for kids, where kids actually get to get their own materials, their own ingredients. And as they're mixing and as they're measuring and as they're kneading and they're baking and they're eating, that's something that I wouldn't be able to do if I was in Warwick, New York, because you would have to get a bus and there's nothing within walking distance. But like I said, you know, you got to find the perspective and the balance to bring urbanization to Warwick, but Warwick to Brooklyn. And that's my balance is what I'm trying to accomplish.
I wouldn't complain about a lesson that has the best pizza in the world. So
there's some really good pizza in Brooklyn, man.
Yeah. One of the things that I was watching a video that talked about how you integrate things like coding into your preschool using no screen robots. Can you kind of talk about the Kibo platform and how that works?
Yeah. Yesterday I had a dad who came on a tour and noticed that there were no screens. And we're like, are you a screen-free school? And I said, look, in all honesty, I have to defend a teacher that wants to maybe play a two-minute interstitial, like a Brain Pop Junior, to try to show condensation. And you could do experiments and activities to get you there, but sometimes that two-minute video really hits the point. But that would be the extent of it. I have tons of companies that I feel are really beautiful that want, that require screens to incorporate the coding. I just think at the age of 2, 3, and 4, it should be a screen-free school. And what I've done is, you know, I've collaborated with different founders of different coding companies. So we have a Twos coding robot that is really genius. They use a train track and a train, and the track holds coins. Now, as the train goes over the colored coin, it results in an action, and the kids start to formulate these beautiful sequences. In our Threes program, you want to evolve it out, right? There's a beautiful company called Sphero and a robot called the Indy. A little more complex. It's a car, and post it like mats, and the kids could create a sequence where they could get their car to literally leave the school if they wanted to. Then in our Fours, because developmentally the kids are scaffolding up in skills, Kibo comes in, which primarily uses QR codes. It's a lot more complex. You definitely can't use it for Twos and Threes. In fact, it was more pioneered and creative for kindergarten and up, but we're bringing it down to the four-year-olds, where my wife, Karen, is a Fours teacher. She actually taught a unit in October on migration, and she coded the Kibos to do a V formation, right? Like, again, how are you going to be able to incorporate decoding into a lesson of migration? Find really creative ways of doing that. And Kibo is one of those powerful platforms where the kids are learning how to sequence, computational thinking and learning is happening, and they don't have to be on a screen, you know?
Just to elaborate a little bit more, just because I think this is such an important point, you are philosophically saying that you want, as much as is practical, your school to be screen-free. Why do you think that's so important for this age group?
I feel like every day and every moment that these kids have outside of school is screen-dependent. I have four kids. You can't get away from it. Yeah. In middle school, they're given screens to complete all of their work, and they find creative loopholes to download other apps and do things. I'm like, at the age of 2, 3, and 4, it's about socialization. Mm-hmm. It's about small group learning, large group learning, parallel play, individual play. When you're on a screen, it's isolated. What process skills? I'm not saying that there aren't process skills that can't be enhanced and developed by using a screen, but that could happen outside of school. Inside of school, it's all about the beautiful social-emotional process. It's about, you know, social-emotional learning. And that has to happen when you're interacting and engaging with adults, with peers, specialists, and all those beautiful features that I believe a school should offer. You know, I have companies, hey, well, I'll give you a smart board. You can borrow it for a month. I guarantee, I just can't pull the trigger. I feel like I'm not there yet, not with this age group.
Yeah, yeah. You know, this is your field, and your school is based upon the premise that early start to education is important. There's a lot of parents that, you know, make the debate about their age of their child. So a two-year-old, do I go to something like what you're offering? Do I just find daycare? Why do you think it's so important for learning, you know, structured learning to begin at an early age like two-year-old?
Yeah. And you're right. I get a parent that'll say, what makes your school better? And my answer is, well, we're not better. We're different. And it's a matter of perspective. Would you rather have your child be in a school where they're just playing all day? I'm not saying that's wrong. Or imagine a place where they're playing all day, but they're not just playing. How are you taking reading and writing and math and art and movement, measuring, fine motor, 3D printing, coding, and small group learning, large group learning? Every kid learns very differently. So all of these domains should be given to a child. Now, when they're just playing, right, it's beautiful. It's independent play. That's wonderful. But what we're trying to do is take the best of all different ideologies. For instance, we'll use Montessori centers, which I do like. We'll create several blocks a day where the child has the independent time, like a daycare, to have what we call center-based play. They get to do what they want, when they want, how they want. If it's Mother's Day, we have 3D printers from Toy Box. 3D print your mommy some flowers. If that's what they want to do, they have the outlet to do it. I want to have independent art time. Yes, 100%, that is a valuable time for a kid to have independent experiences. But should it be all day long? Of course not. Or can a child facilitate and lead themselves? No. Also, differentiated instruction is so key and critical at the age of 2, 3, and 4. If a child's going to have a strength, let's turn it to a greater strength, a weakness into a strength. If you are not creating lesson plans and you're not thinking about structure, you're going to leave your kids with those limitations because you're not able to kind of target them. A lesson plan is a roadmap, right? So what we're doing is we're looking at our overall thematic units, which we break down daily to weekly to obviously monthly, but then we're looking at the framework of who is this individual child and incorporating what it is that they need within each daily lesson plan. That's the difference between a daycare where they're free playing all day or the Brooklyn Preschool of Science where they're playing all day, but they're learning while they're playing. They don't even realize that it's happening.
Yeah, yeah. When I was going through your website, and for listeners and viewers on YouTube, the link to the Brooklyn Preschool of Science will accompany the text in the podcast, so you can look at the description and be able to get to the school through that link. When I was reviewing the website, though, one of the things that I, you know, found really helpful for parents that don't live in Brooklyn and, you know, teachers who don't live in Brooklyn is you've got a lot of videos. You've got even some lessons like the volcano that are available on the website. So I would encourage, you know, listeners and viewers to just go to the school website and take a look at the resources that are in there to get ideas and even some resources that you might be able to utilize yourself. But you know, with you, Carmelo, with you on the podcast right now, I want to kind of throw some concepts out at you and have you think through, based upon your experiences, ways that you might approach teaching these concepts to children that are very young. So the twos, the threes, the fours. So the first one is like number sense. Like how do students make sense of quantifying and what numbers mean?
October. We have a beautiful farmer's market that comes to Brooklyn right off of Court Street. Let's think about the fall festival, autumn science. We have farms that will deliver us pallets of pumpkins, and you have children collecting pumpkins. Imagine taking out the seeds, right? I mean, it's sensory, it's fine motor, but imagine sequencing the seeds in groups of threes or fours or fives. Mm. Our four-year-olds, kid you not, we give them 1-inch squares. I could teach them to measure the diameter of their pumpkin in the most hands-on, fun, effective way. Again, I mean, a four-year-old learning about diameter? Yeah, right. Because we're using a pumpkin that they just excavated out, that it became very personal, and you're connecting the math concept. But more importantly, you're not teaching it out of context. You're teaching it within the context of that pumpkin that they just excavated. So again, you're making these beautiful connections where they don't even realize that they're... And it's not important to just even, like, to try to... Not saying vocabulary is not the goal here, but you don't have to worry about them remembering the diameter, but they will remember they had the largest pumpkin in the room if that was the child that had a 10-inch wide diameter pumpkin, right? That's an example of how we could connect math.
What about extending that if you learn about numbers through a project like that? What about getting into basic calculation?
A lot of times what teachers will do is going back to, let's just say, I just to throw a different topic, mealworms, right? Giving kids unit fix cubes to measure their mealworm and giving a kid three mealworms and asking them to total what the length would be of the three. There's so many, and the reason why I wanted to shift to mealworms is we could go from something that's so static like a pumpkin to something that's like so fluid like a mealworm. But when there's a mealworm that's scurrying around the table, one child's gently holding it down while another child's putting Unifix cubes alongside of it. You're then giving them a piece of paper so that they could chart how many Unifix cubes long it was, plus the second and the third. And look at how easy I just made addition happen, you know?
Going into more geometry, thinking about spatial awareness, shape awareness, what are some techniques that you use?
Today? We're in the middle of a unit called States of Matter, right? Solids, liquids, gases, and mixing different liquids to possibly make different gases. Imagine giving a child a balloon with air, giving a child a balloon with maybe some shaving cream in it, giving a child a balloon maybe with a little bit of liquid in it, and having them throw it into the air and how they have to react with trying to catch it. Physical, spatial awareness, movement, motion, forces. Again, plus that's gross motor. There's just so many beautiful ways that you could connect spatial awareness, a child's body and movement and how things are moving with their body, and incorporating it right now in our unit of matter study.
Last example, pattern recognition.
Pattern recognition. I'll shift. Migration. I talked about my wife with the V formation, right, with the Kibo units. Imagine giving kids different feathers, turkey feathers, which we actually do, and having the kids create patterns with their feathers, right? And or give them a feather activity sheet, and they're going to have to match the actual feather that they have with the big quills, and sometimes we'll actually turn them into old school, like George Washington pens. But again, that look how effective that is by using nothing but feathers.
Those are all really great examples. You mentioned, I know your philosophy is screen-free. You did talk earlier about, you know, sort of the rise of artificial intelligence and big computing. I mean, you know, there's so much that goes into that. How do you start to think about ways to connect the dots for very young children to the fact that they're going to be living and hopefully thriving in what has become a digital world that is filled with, you know, a digital reality that isn't tangible, but yet is so essential really to everything that they're going to be doing?
I think the biggest connector will be having children never be afraid to ask the questions right? I remember when I was teaching kids at PS261, there would be so many children who would be so afraid to answer a question because they'd be afraid that they were going to be wrong. Like math, if the answer is wrong, it's wrong. You can get points on the process, but a lot of times teachers are like, that's right and that's wrong, right? I think the beauty of the inquiry and what's going to eventually be a catalyst to their success in an AI world in the future is, you know, it's exponential growth. You can't be afraid to ask the questions because the questions that you may seem foolish today are going to be actually in existence tomorrow at some capacity, right? So the STEM, the STEAM, the inquiry, the passion of asking the questions will, I feel, be a catalyst to have a child survive in a technology-driven world where you're going to have to keep asking the questions to keep the evolution that's going to be exponential, obviously, going, you know?
Yeah. I think my last question, as I've listened to you talk, and as I've learned, you know, reacquainted myself with the school, I think that our culture, not just recently, but literally since the 1950s, has created this discursive binary where we talk about STEM and then everything else. And then we try to sort of morph that and say, well, STEAM. And when I hear you talk about the way that you work with your students, it's almost like that bifurcation is so artificial because when I hear you talk about the types of projects that you've done and when you just went through those examples with me, it's hard for me to see that you're saying this is a science lesson. It's more like a experience lesson that involves a lot of different things. I mean, you want to respond to that?
Yeah. You know, a lot of times my students will leave me. Go to kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and then they'll come back in third and fourth grade, and I'll be like, hey, Ethan, what's going on? How's school? That's just not fun. I'm like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, it's like you just said. It's a separate literacy block, completely isolated from a math block. There is no longer, like, if when I was a kid, there was cooking class and shop and woodworking. Yeah. It doesn't exist anymore. We've moved away from that. There's a whole mindset and a whole group of people that learn, you know, with their hands. Doesn't exist today. But I guess the point is, when you have a STEM-based philosophy, it kind of encompasses all different experiences so that all children can thrive with an ideology like that. You're not leaving anybody back, right? Because there are kids that want to be the next mechanics of the world. That's just who they are. Not everybody's college bound.
Yeah.
Right. Like today, I mean, everybody feels like they have to go to college. That's not true. Why is that the case? You know, like there are a lot of kids that could be, if we create a passion of hands-on learning, you know, the future electricians, though I'm reading articles that the next millionaire group is going to be plumbers because it's something that AI would be very difficult to take place, you know?
Is there a last question? I always like to ask, you know, questions that sort of get at, you know, people's asset experiences that really, you know, stick in their mind. You've taught a lot of kids. You've had a lot of kids come through your school. Can you think about an aha moment where you saw, and I'm sure you see this every day, so it's kind of an unfair question, but what does an aha moment look like where you know, okay, that student just had something big that unlocked for them as they went through this?
And it's really odd that you're asking me this question. Over the winter break, in one week, I had two former students email me. One wrote to me, Carmelo, you haven't taught me in over 20 years. And I just want to say your passion in science motivated me so much. She became a doctor. She has a family. She has children. And I sat back and honestly, it just gave me chills just now. Yeah. I'll give you a second version. There was a former student at PS261 that I taught when she was 5, 6, 7, and 8, loved the science methodology portion of education. I leave PS261 to become the Brooklyn Preschool founder. She is now the science teacher at PS261, and she emailed me, and the only reason why she did it was how much she loved the way I taught science to the kids, and she's following that whole inquiry-based format. And you just stop, and you're like, Matt, you are having an impact on the lives of students. And more importantly, too, there are no metrics when you go into public school because it's zoned. But I am realizing that a lot of my kids, and I'm not advocating for private schools, I'm just saying private schools are more, they're testing, they're observing kids in an in-school, coming into my school. My kids are getting into the hardest private schools in the community. And I'm realizing that we're not creating the smartest kids. That's not what they're looking for. They're looking for kids that love to learn. Yeah. They're looking for kids that are passionate learners. They're looking for kids that can adapt to different situations. And this is something that we do and we do really well. And to me, like, that's just like when you're hearing former students come back becoming future engineers and future doctors and then becoming future educators, I'm like, listen, I feel like I've accomplished my life mission already, you know?
Yeah, that's like so great to have you back on. And, you know, the passion that you exude, you know, when you're talking about the way that you interact with your students, is just contagious. And so I really appreciate you coming back on to tell your story.
I want you to come to Brooklyn. We'll have a great pizza slice. I'll show you this. No, one day we'll meet, you know.
You know, actually, I get to the city, you know, about once a year. And so know that the next time that I'll be there, I'm coming. So,
okay, I'm counting down the days.
Yeah, absolutely. My guest today has been Carmelo Piazza. He's the executive director and education director for the Brooklyn Preschool of Science. You can learn more about Carmelo and the Preschool of Science by visiting their website, which is in the text that accompanies the podcast. Thanks so much to April Koska and Trinity Sweet for their work behind the scenes as associate producers on the podcast. If you'd like to reach out with ideas, comments, or suggestions, you can email us at teachingmatterspodcast, all one word, all lowercase, at ohio.edu. Thank you all so much for listening, and we hope you have a great day.